Paraklamet Beis are a very discreet segment in the book of Yecheskel, which deals with prophecies regarding the Umos HaOlam, regarding the various nations of the world. Again, without repeating everything we've mentioned last week, but again, it's important to recognize that there is a fundamental discussion in the Rishonim as to what is the purpose of prophecies that the prophet talks about the non-Jews. In other words, is this a mission to the non-Jewish world, Dalim Du Tshuva, or is this something for the Jewish people to be aware of? Now, the truth is, most of the time, these nevuas were not intended to be communicated to the non-Jews. The only exception is Yonah. Yonah, the prophet, is given a mission to go to Nineveh. But when Yechezkel is told about Phoenicia and about Ammon and Moab and Mitzrayim, he is not told, go to Paro, like Moshe, and tell him these things. So most of the Mefarshim understand that the nevuas in Yechezkel are not really directed to the Umos HaOlam per se, but the nevuas in Yechezkel here are directed to the Bnei Yisrael. That the point is, Bnei Yisrael's spirit is going to be broken by the Churban and by the Golos, and they're going to see the great success and triumph of all the nations that practiced evil, and as it were, that can shake a person's emuna to the core when they see how the those who do evil prosper, and those who write the old question of why do the righteous suffer, why do the wicked prosper. And therefore these nevuos are a form of reassurance and nechama, reassurance and comfort to the Jewish people, that eventually those who do evil shall meet their downfall and shall meet their destruction. And thus, the message is not so much for the Umos HaOlam per se, the message is for Bnei Yisrael, and therefore, technically, this would fit within what Chazal call Nechama. They divide the book of Yechezkel into two parts. They say, Yechezkel, the beginning is Puranus, the beginning is tragedy, and that's clearly from Perek Aleph to Perek Chafdalet, 24 Prakim of very, very strong tragedy. And it says the end of Yechezkel is Nechama, is comfort. Now we're going to see there's a lot of Nechama, there's a lot of messianic prophecies, but Chazal do not describe how do we characterize the bridge, these like seven Prakim in the middle, which deal with the nations of the world. But again, according to these Mefarshim, they would characterize those Nevuas as also Nechama, because not that, God forbid, we have any joy when people suffer. That's not why it's a Nechama. But it's a Nechama because it reminds us of the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does eventually destroy that which is evil and rewards that which is righteous. And that gives a person a Nechama that, therefore, if I do tshuva, I will merit a redemption.
They would say initially that not being happy about the downfall of any of your enemies.
Right.
And follow
Yevech
al Tishma. And we were talking about the, now whether that was, whether Shlomo Melech was talking about Ayev and him cooking, just been talking about Rishayim. Is it, and not being misled about the Hatzachat, the success of the Rasha? Are we talking, when we talk in terms of, we have the, we have the prototype already of not being happy when other nations fall. But are we allowed a modicum of joy? I mean, and when a Kadosh Baruch Hu uses this as an achama, that sort of contradicts the concept.
Yeah, there is. The Gemara itself asks, there is another verse in Mishlei that says, Be'ibud Rishayim Rina, upon the destruction of the evildoers.
Yeah, what parak is that?
There is Rina, there is joyous sword. Yeah, there, by the way, I want to tell you, you see that Chazal themselves grappled with this. Let's take the very famous Medrash, which is always cited as the main source for not rejoicing when evildoers suffer. This is, of course, the Medrash that says when the Jews were, when the Mitzrayim were drowning in the Yamsuf, so the angels wanted to sing the song of praise to Hashem. So what did Hashem say? Hashem said, "Masa yadai tavu bayam," the creatures of my hands are drowning in the ocean. Vatem omrim shira, you want to praise me? So normally we interpret this to mean the Egyptians. Hashem, as it were, is expressing a sadness that the Egyptians themselves are dying, even though they're evil and they deserve to die. But there's still a sadness that's involved. Yeah.
You know, the Egyptian people were not evil. It's the Pharaoh was evil. So that's why it started,
yeah.
And they followed the heart this month, because the Egyptians themselves were just...
Well, you know, it's very hard to say. You know, obviously, when I'm not talking about the modern Egyptians. We're talking about the ancient Egyptians.
I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
We don't really have... I don't think we have a record regarding any, you know, the personal...
Pharaoh, yes, because when they left, so they gave them all,
Well, okay, you know, it's true that... It is true that the Egyptians did... want the Jews to leave a lot earlier than Paro wanted them to leave.
Yeah, because they were afraid not to die.
That's correct, but that was still after 210 years. So it wasn't that. In other words, you're right. Paro was worse than the Egyptians, but you know, I don't think we see necessarily that much benevolence or compassion. Although the Torah says again, the Torah says, "Beferish, you should not despise an Egyptian because you were strangers in their lands." So there is an element
of
hospitality.
But the enemy of today is all of them, individual, all
yes,
of them.
Yes, that's different. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, obviously, the modern Egyptians, as you know, are not the ancient Egyptians. The modern Egyptians are an Arab people. The ancient Egyptians are from Cham, from Canaan. But the point I wanted to bring out is this, though. That is the text, that notion of Hashem saying, Masa yadai tava biyam, the creatures of my hands are drowning in the sea. Vatem omrim shira, how can you praise me? That has always been taken to be the attitude of the Nefola Yevecha al Tismach, do not rejoice in the downfall of your enemies. And that's why we pour out the wine when we say the 10 plagues, because we don't want to be besimcha. According to another Medrash, that is why we only say a part Hallel during the other days of Pesach, because we don't want to rejoice. And yet what's interesting is, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, this identical Medrash is given a different twist. And that is to say, Ma'aseh Yadai, it says, doesn't say Tovu Bayam, it says Ma'aseh Yadai Nisunim Basakana, which means totally different emphasis. What Hashem is telling the angels is, don't sing yet, the Jewish people are still in trouble. Which means, according to that, in other words, it's the same Midrashic text, it's given a totally different meaning, that Hashem's concern is not for the Egyptians, but Hashem is telling the angels, it's too early to sing. The Jewish people are still in potential danger. Don't do it. So you see from these traditions that on one reading of Chazal of that Midrashic idea was to express empathy and rachmanus even for those who hate us and those who try to destroy us. The other is focusing more on Jewish interest. It was a question. So Chazal themselves were mesubic, but it seems like this. It's a mix. There's a mixture of sadness and joy. There is joy in Kiddush Hashem. There is a joy in the realization of God's purpose on earth, that evil is vanquished and goodness triumphs. And there is a joy in the fact that we now see that things have a pattern, things make sense, that goodness is rewarded and evil is punished. There is a joy in that. However, there is a sadness that particular people have to suffer. And it goes back to Yitamu Chataim, right? The famous remark that Bruria made when Rav Meir was praying that certain evil people should die because they were bothering him, torturing him. And Bruria said, it says in the verse, Yitamu Chataim, the sins should die, should be destroyed, not the sinner. You don't pray for them. But
like Jacob that cursed the anger of...
Right, you curse the anger, you don't curse the person. Right, that's right, that's right. The same idea. So you hate... The Balat Tanya says, is there a mitzvah to hate Rishayim? It says, you hate the evil within them. Yeah, you're supposed to hate the evil within them, but you love them. You love the good within them. You love them, but you hate the evil that is within them. So so you're correct, that although b'nefala yevacha al tismach, that in the downfall of our enemies we don't rejoice, but nevertheless, the nevuos towards the umos ha'olam are considered to be a form of nechama, because they do establish the notion of Kiddush Hashem, that God's promise and God's malchus shall be realized by this, the owners of the Rishayim.
So, Rabbi, I'm confused though. When you there's a fine line there between hating the deed and accepting the doer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people like Hamas, the character of Saddam Hussein. To hate the terrorism and the evil deeds, but how does that effectively, how do I treat them then?
The thing is...
Support their annihilation?
Well, that's the point. You support their annihilation with a feeling of sadness. You take the gun, you shoot him, and you feel bad about it. But that's the point. The point is, a Jew should not be happy that human beings have become so evil that they have to be destroyed. but there's still a recognition that, that a rodef, someone that tries to destroy you or destroy the Jewish people or destroy anybody, you get rid of him. Above the heart, Avada. In other words, certainly the attitude is do what must be done, but always do so with a feeling of not regrets, because regret would mean you wish you didn't do it, but a feeling of sadness that you were forced to do it. It's not regret. And yeah, Golda Meir used to say, again, people, I mentioned this, people either love this or they hate it. Some people get very angry with this quote, but it's what Golda Meir said. I'll just share it with you. She said that we could forgive the Arabs for killing our children, we cannot forgive the Arabs for making our children kill theirs. Again, some people get very infuriated with the first part of the sentence. But all right, be it as it may, but there's a fundamental, there's a very, very valuable truth in the second half of the sentence. And that is that for a Jew to have to become a killer is also a tragedy. It's not, and again, without saying which is greater, I mean, they're all tragedies, but there's a tragedy in Jews being killed. There's also a tragedy in a Jew having to become a killer as well, because we become debased. I mean, inevitably we become, there's a certain corruption. In fact, that's what Rashi actually says this in the Chumash. I think Rashi, Golda Meir maybe was mechavenet to Rashi. Rashi says by when Yaakov encounters Esav, so the pasuk says Vayira Yaakov Maot, Yaakov is very afraid. Vayitzer lo, and he is distressed. So Rashi says Vayira Yaakov Maot Shema Yehareg. Yaakov is afraid. Maybe he will be killed. Vayitzar lo shema yaharog. Yaakov is afraid. Maybe he'll have to kill. So your mama see this. That's also something that concerns Yaakov Avinu. Just so. That's very true. But anyway, we start. Especially, yeah. Okay, all right. Well, you're right. But you know, we're brothers somewhat to the Arab nations too. I mean, Yitzchak and Yishmael. We were, you know, we are brothers. We're cousins at least, going through Yaakov. Yaakov and Esav are described as brothers, not only in the Chumash, but even in the Nevi'im. Hallo, ach, Esav LeYaakov. Esav is a brother of Yaakov. But we were saying that Perek Chaf Hei, which we looked at very, very quickly, is very perfunctory. It deals with four nations, just in a few very quick verses. And again, just to remind you of the nations. It dealt with the destruction of Ammon and Moab, and then Edom, Esav, and the Pelishtim. And it devotes very few verses to each. Again, I just to remind you all of the very important idea that of all of these prophecies, the one nation that Yechezkel does not talk about as being destroyed is he does not talk about the downfall of Babel. This is very, very conspicuous. In the book of Yirmiyahu, which also contains Nevuos against the Umos HaOlam, Yirmiyahu's primary subject matter is that eventually there will be a Mapala of Malchus Bavel. Yechezkel talks about Pelishtim, and he talks about Pelishtim were not even a big power at that time. Ammon and Moab were also not particularly significant. Mitzrayim was a world power. He talks about Mitzrayim in four chapters devoted to Egypt, who was not even directly involved in the Churban, but nothing of Bavel. And again, we mentioned last week various reasons why. Basically, politically speaking, remember, Yirmiyahu is prophesying from the land of Israel, Meretz Yisrael. Yechezkel is in Bavel, and Yechezkel, therefore, is not in a position where he can talk about the downfall of Nebuchadnezzar. And this is really a fulfillment. The Mefarshim say, Yechezkel is fulfilling Yirmiyahu's directive of Dirshu Shalom Ha'ir, that when the Jews go to Bavel, they should seek the welfare of Bavel. Right, the whole source. Not all shall do it, but the whole source of praying for the governments, right? We have a tefillah l'shalom ha'medina, is learned out of Yirmiyahu's directive to the Jews going to Bavel of Dirshu Shalom Ho'ir, that you should seek the welfare of your society. And therefore, it's not consistent with that for Yechezkel to be talking about the downfall of Nebuchadnezzar. Also, insofar as Golus is concerned, Bavel was a relatively benign Golus. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, in the very beginning, he had Daniel, he threw people in the Kivshan Ha'esh, he threw Daniel in the lion's den, and he threw Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah in the Kivshan Ha'esh, but that was before the Churban. But apparently it was understood that for the 52 years that they were there from the Churban till Ezra went up, it was considered to be a fairly benign benign period.
There is the first of two Daniel to the
I don't remember. I think it was the Nebuchadnezzar. I'm pretty sure it was the Nebuchadnezzar, because this is before the Churban. This is before the Churban. I mean, Darius the First wouldn't have been until many years later. Yeah. Okay, but be it as it may, it is very, very notable. This is an example where silence speaks more eloquently than words, that with all of Yechezkel's messages, there is no mention at all of the Mapala of Babel. Now, some of Farshim want to say, he does talk briefly about the downfall of Ashur. Ashur is Assyria. And in a way, that's historically anomalous, because Assyria had been conquered by Babel. But some want to say that he is alluding to the world power that succeeded Ashur, which was Babel. So some want to say that indirectly he is talking about Babel when he talks about Ashur, but there is clearly no direct reference to Ashur. Let me just say a few more words about the three nations that are described in Perek Chaf Hei: Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Now, where they occupied, the land that they occupied, we know that Moab and Ammon occupied the east bank. They were basically in the east bank of the Yarden River. And Edom, which is Esav, is to the south, and this would be northern Saudi Arabia. This would be south of the Dead Sea. Some say Edom extended up to Petra. Some say, but also extended much further south into Saudi Arabia. Yeah, some say Petra was also the upper level of Mount Seir. Now, we know that the characteristic of these three nations, very interestingly enough, is that we were not allowed to conquer their lands when we came out of Mitzrayim. We were told not to wage war with Ammon and Moab, because they are the descendants of Lot, and Hashem gave them this land. Same thing with Esav. We were not allowed to wage war with Esav, unless they attack us, of course, because in effect, these are descendants of Abraham who have certain entitlements to this land until the time of Mashiach. But the emes is, Rashi explains based on the Medrash, that if you go back to the Bris Ben Habsarim, the covenant that Hashem made with Avram, if you remember, Avram asked Hashem, what is the proof that my children are going to get Eretz Yisrael? So Hashem told him to cut up some animals, and they represent korbanos, and a fire came, and it was dark, and Avram fell into a deep slumber, and Hashem gave him the prophecy that your children shall be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. And that refers to Mitzrayim and the other exiles, and it runs from the birth of Yitzchak, because from that time they were strangers, even in Eretz Yisrael. So it doesn't say they will be slaves in Egypt for 400 years, because they weren't in Egypt 400 years. They were only in Egypt 210 years. But the point is,
slavery
ki ger,
is 210.
Huh?
Slavery is 210. Well, they were 400.
No, not in Egypt. No, no. They were in Mitzrayim 210 years, and most of that time was not slavery either, because part of that is Yosef's life. The 400 years, Rashi says, runs from the birth of Yitzchak. That it was 400 years from the time Yitzchak was born in Eretz Israel, till the time they left Egypt was 400 years. And even though it says in the book of Shmos that the Moshav B'nai Yisrael in Mitzrayim, the number of years they were in Egypt was 430 years, where do you get that? So Rashi says it was 430 years from the Bris Ben Habsarim, because the Bris Ben Habsarim was when Avraham was 70 years old. Yitzchak was born when Avraham was 100 years old. So it was 430 years from the Bris Ben Habsarim, 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak, but only 210 years in Mitzrayim itself. But that's why the pasuk does not say your children will be slaves for 400 years. It says they shall be strangers in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. That can include Yitzchak's life in Eretz Yisrael, where unlike Avram, who was always recognized as Nasi Elokim, a prince of God, Yitzchak was persecuted even in Eretz Yisrael. So the geirus, The notion of being an alien, a stranger, existed from Yitzchak. But the point is that at the end of the Bris Bein Habsarim, the Pasuk says, Bayom Ahu, that day, just read to thee, that day Hashem made a covenant with Avraham.
I don't understand why there would be stranger in Israel, since it was supposed to be the land that they...
Yes, but Israel is filled. I mean, how many, you have Avraham, you have Yitzchak, you have a handful of people.
Yeah.
And all the nations who lived in Israel did not recognize them as the owners. They persecuted them. And this was a decree of Hashem that until we leave Mitzrayim and we conquer Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't mean that it was our land, but nope, they didn't recognize the Umos that lived there did not mm-hmm. recognize the land as our land.
The land was not Avram's yet either. I mean, that was the whole source of the conflict between the shepherds.
No, that's true. But first of all, you're talking about, well, okay, there's a chronological problem here. But first of all, it's true that it may start from Avram. But Hashem said, Ki ger yihyeh zar'acha. In other words, if Hashem would have said, you and your children will be strangers, maybe that could start from Avraham. But the gezeirah that your children will be strangers cannot start until you have a child. So it starts from there.
But gerim yihyu, gerim means Mitzrayim gerim, not in... So
that's the answer. The answer is that it does not say in Mitzrayim. It says, Be'eretz lo lahem. So that includes Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, in the... this is one of the things that the... You know, remember the story with the 70 elders who Talmai HaMelech told me hired to translate the Torah? And he put them in 70 different rooms. He wanted to have them come up with the right mm-hmm. translation. And with Ruach HaKodesh, they all came up with the exact translation. And one of the things that they changed, mm-hmm. they added things. When it says, Ki ger yezaracha, they will be slaves, arba meot shana, so they said, so they put, b'mitzrayim u'bishar aratzos. They put, so they wanted to avoid that problem. They also changed, remember, Arneves was, which means a rabbit, is a non-kosher animal, and that was Talmai's wife's name, so they changed that also.
Yeah. At the time that the Jews acquired ownership of land, whether we consider it from the time of Abraham or after the Kibbutz
right.
Ha'aretz,
right.
would the Jews have been obligated to purchase properties? I'm asking specifically regarding Marat HaMachpelah. If Abraham had ownership of the land, then he, in effect, wouldn't have had to buy it.
That's correct. That's considered to be one of the trials according to some midrashim. It's a machlokas, but some midrashim say one of the 10 nisyonas of Avraham was buying the Maris of Machpelah, even though and the reason that's so is because it was his land. It was, and yet they wouldn't recognize it as his land. It's very interesting that if you think about this, I'll tell you another thing too. There are three places in Eretz Yisrael that were purchased by the Avos. Or at least purchased by in Tanakh. One is Maras HaMachpelah in Chevron, and one is Shechem. Yaakov bought Shechem, B'meya Kesita, and the third is the Har HaBayis, the Temple Mount that was purchased by David. Now you may say, why do we have to purchase it? It's our property. But it's interesting that someone is saying, Hashem saw with Ruach HaKodesh what would be the most hotly contested areas that are ours in the land of Israel. Chevron, and Shechem, uh-huh. Nablus is an Arab city, and the Temple Mount, the Har HaBayis. So Hashem, as it were, didn't want us to claim title only because of divine promises, since he wanted us to buy it. And as a result, the Hashgacha created it, specifically these situations that we bought. But I wanted to read you this verse in the Bris Bein Habsarim, where it says, Vayom Ahu, that day, Karas Hashem es Avram Bris Lamer, Hashem made a covenant with Avram, Lezarecha Nasati Esarz, I have given the land, I have given, the past, it's as if it's already a reality, I have given the land to your children, from Nahar Mitzrayim, Ad Nahar Gadol Nahar. So these boundaries are huge. Nahar Mitzrayim, some say it's actually the Nile, some say it's the various tributaries, but it goes from that point all the way to the Euphrates River. That goes, up to Turkey. And it mentions the famous seven nations, Chiti, Prizi, Rephaim, which is also Canaanim, etc. But it mentions three extra nations, the Cani, Kenizi, and Kadmoni. There's a total of 10 nations here. And Rashi says, Hashem made a bris with Abraham to give him land that was occupied by 10 nations. However, three of those nations, we will not get the land until the days of Mashiach. And the Cani, Kenizi, and Kadmoni are identified with Ammon, Moab, and Edom. That Ammon, Moab, and Edom are three nations whose lands we were not even permitted to conquer when we are going to Eretz Yisrael from Mitzrayim, and yet the Yosid Lava, we're going to have those three nations. Now, the way it works is this. In reality, it's not that they weren't given to Avraham. They were given to Avraham, but they were set aside for those children of Avraham. Lot is considered also the
family.
Right, the same family, but Yosid Lava, it'll go to Bnei Yisrael. So the truth is that Ammon, Moab, and Edom, we kind of have a hands-off attitude until the days of Mashiach, but they are within the 10 nations that Hashem promised promised Abraham.
You know, when Jacob sent his son, he said, Redu means
210
years.
That's right. So they were not, that's correct.
Years, yeah.
So they were not in Mitzrayim 400 years, only 210 years. And of those 210
years, how many years were in slavery?
Slavery, well, you have to calculate. The slavery did not begin until Yosef died. And Yosef was the first of the, actually, all of the brothers, V'yamas Yosef V'chol Echav. So the slavery did not begin till the last brother died. Yosef was the first brother who died, actually. Now, we could figure out when Yosef died, because, let's see, we could figure it out. Yaakov came to Mitzrayim when he was 130. Okay, so first 17, and Yaakov died at 147. So for sure, the first 17 years of Mitzrayim, I mean, there was no slavery then. Yosef then, the question is, how old was Yosef at the time? So we can figure it out. Yosef was 39. That's correct, because Yosef was sold. Let's figure out, I always forget this one second. Yosef was sold at 17, that's right. Yosef was sold at 17. Okay, but whatever, he was gone for 22 years. In other words, Yosef was reunited with Yaakov 22 years later. So Yosef was 39 when Yaakov came to Mitzrayim. Now, Yosef died at 110. Okay, so let's figure it out. Yosef was 39 when Yaakov came. Yaakov lived 17 years in Mitzrayim. So 39 plus 17... It was 56. Yosef was 56 when his father died. Yosef lived 110 years. So how many more years is that? 54. Huh? 54. 7 and 4 is 11. All right, so we can say with certainty that it was 71 years from the time Yaakov came to Mitzrayim till Yosef died. It was 71 years. So for the first 71 years, there clearly was no slavery. And then the only thing I don't know, then we have to factor in how much longer the other brothers lived. So you add 71 plus the remaining years of the other brothers, and all of those years were years not of slavery. So you see, we're already approaching almost half, the halfway point.
That's 100 years.
Right. So the slavery was not very long, and we are told that the torture and the physical deprivation was only around 80 years, the last 80 years. From the time of Moshe Rabbeinu's birth began the Enoch.
One generation?
Well, 80 years, yeah, well, 80 years, yeah. But so even of those 210 years, a large proportion of it was not slavery. In other words, there are three stages. There's Gerus, the notion of being a stranger, Avdus, being a slave, and Enoi. Enoi is physical affliction and torture. So there are three stages. Ki ger yiyazaracha, v'yavadum, v'inu osam, arba me'oshana. But the arba me'oshana does not have to be all inui, all abdus, all... In other words, in the 400 years, there will be three stages. Abdus, gerus, abdus, inui. Okay. So that was that's the subject matter of Perek Chafhei. The Mapala of Moab, Edom, the Plishtim, and Esav. And keep in mind that what is significant is all of these four nations at this point in time are minor nations. They are not world powers anymore. I mean, they are all under the yoke of Bavel. They are insignificant nations. And yet what HaKadosh Baruch Hu criticizes them for is not for what they did to the Jewish people, but for the joy that they experienced as the Jewish people are being humiliated and being destroyed. Because the truth is, in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbon, it's not just the action that counts, but it's the joy and the enthusiasm. If you watch, this is called, in fact, this is even a very serious aveira among human beings on an individual basis. This is called mischabed biklon chaveiro. You get pleasure and you get honor in someone else's misfortune. And even though you say, I didn't do it, it happened, I had nothing to do with it. But one who gets a sense of joy at someone else's misfortune.
It's like the Hamas today, when they kill, they blame and they're happy.
Yeah, yeah, but they also do it. I'm saying that even if you don't do it, like the people in Jordan who were very happy that someone actually, even though they didn't do it, but in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbon, that would be very, very serious, as if they did the Aveira itself. So Perek Chafei is very, very bekitzer, very abbreviated, because basically it's not dealing with world powers at all. These are insignificant nations. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying that there is a din for those who derive joy at the downfall of others.
Even going, is it one of the
mitzvahs we know? No, well, it's not expressed in terms of a commandment per se, but it's a very destructive character trait.
So all
human beings have to absorb that midah. Now we then come to a next unit of three perakim. So now we have a much greater number of psukim: Perek Chafav, Perek Chafzayin, Perek Chafches. These are three whole perakim. And they deal with a prophecy of the nation of Tsor. Now, Tsor is Tyre in English. Tyre was Phoenicia. It's a great kingdom that was north of Eretz Yisrael, where Lebanon is basically, where Lebanon is today. And Tsor, as you know, the Phoenicians were renowned as great maritime people. They did trading, very, very wealthy in commerce. And what's interesting is that Yechezkel talks about an ignominious end, and historians tell us Nebuchadnezzar, at this point Tsor was still flourishing. It was not an empire in territory that much, but it was very, very wealthy because of trading. And Nebuchadnezzar waged a 13-year siege against Tsor. He couldn't break them for 13 years. And Yechezkel, in a sense, is the one that prophesies that Tyre, Tsor, shall be broken. And what's interesting is that Tsor seems to have had a very good relationship with the Jewish people. In the time of Shlomo HaMelech, Hiram, Melech Tsor, right? Hiram, the king of Tsor, was the one who supplied much of the raw materials, the wood and the gold and the silver. I mean, it wasn't necessarily a gift, although some of it was a gift. Some of it was purchased. We are told, by the way, this is an interesting instance of land transfer. The Mefarshim have a halachic problem with it. The pasuk says that Shlomo gave Chira Melech Tzor 20 cities. So there is an issur in the Torah. There's an issur called Lo Seichanem. Lo Seichanem, which literally means do not show the nation's grace, is taken to mean that it is forbidden under Torah law to sell to a non-Jew property in the land of Israel. Now, again, this is not directly relevant on a land for peace issue, because obviously, if it is felt, if a judgment is made that this is necessary to save life, so again, I'm not getting into the politics of it, but certainly, just like Pikuach Nefesh says you can drive on Shabbos, so Pikuach Nefesh says you could sell land to a goy if it'll save life. I mean, that's the debate. But certainly, if it's not a question of Pikuach Nefesh, one is not allowed to sell land to a non-Jew. In fact, is that one of the shilas about what they do during Shemitah, what the Rabbanut does in Israel to allow farmers to cultivate the lands in Israel, is that all the land is sold to a goy, like we sell our chametz to a goy. Mm-hmm. All the land is sold to a goy, permitting cultivation. Now, many of the more observant would not accept that for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons is that the claim is that it's against the halacha to sell land to a non-Jew because of los echanim. So it's absolutely clear that if you, for example, own a house in Israel, you would not be allowed to sell it to a non-Jew. I mean, that is a clear
isn't
halacha.
Is there a special law in Israel that you don't even own your homeland? You're renting it for 99 years?
Well, that's not a halacha. I mean, a lot of the land is owned by the Jewish National Fund. That's true. But even a house, so even if you own a house,
right.
You can't
sell
your
house. Right, you don't
that,
own.
That's true for around 90% of the land. That happens to be true. But for all practical purposes, they're not going to kick you out. The Jewish National Fund is not going to evict you. I mean, in all practical purposes, you are
right.
You are really treated like an owner. But in either event, one of the kashas that is asked is, how could Shlomo give Hiram Melech Tzur 20 ayoros? So the Abarbanel says that it doesn't mean he gave them territory, but he gave them the taxes that were generated by those communities. He gave them those tax rights, or he gave them tribute from those cities, but not the actual cities themselves.
So
okay.
It was not the cities that he gave.
That's right. So some Mefarshim learned it was not actual cities. But be it as it may, Hiram is described as a kind of a friend of the Jewish people. And yet, in Perek Chafav, we talk about the Phoenicians generally, and specifically in Perek Chafches, there was a whole discussion of Hiram Melech Tzur. Now, there's a lot of problems here. First of all, there's an indication that Hiram Melech Tzur is still alive. Now, if this is the same guy, and the Midrash will talk about this, this is over, remember, Hiram Melech Tzur was king of Phoenicia at the beginning of Shlomo HaMelech's reign, at the beginning of the reign. Right. Now, the Beis HaMikdash was up 410 years. So we're talking about a person who is at least 500 years old, or around that age. Now, according to another, and indeed there are some Midrashim that say that as a reward for Hiram building the Beis HaMikdash, he was given this, amazingly long life of 500 years. Some of Farshim even say more, because the name Hiram, not Hiram per se, but a variant of Hiram, even appears in the Chumash itself. If you remember the story of Yehuda and Tamar, going all the way back and by Yitzchak, he's only mentioned once, and we're not given any detail about him. But it mentions that Yehuda. Let me just find it here. Sorry, it's Vayeshev, After Mechiras Yosef. So it says, the Pasuk says, Vayehi ba'esahi, after Mechiras Yosef, Vayered Yehuda me'esachav, Yehuda separated from his brothers, and Chazal say actually because he was doing tshuva for selling Yosef, Vayet Adish Adulam, he went to a man in the town of Adulam, Ushmo Chira. The name of the man was Chira. Now, Chira is not the same as Hiram, but there is a medrash that wants to identify Chira and Hiram. And what did this man Hiram do? He didn't do anything, but Yehuda just met a woman and he got married to her. But according to one medrash in Chazal, this man who later became the king of Phoenicia was this Ish Adulami, whose name was Chira. Now, if it's the same person, if you add up the figures, this puts Hiram at an age of 1,200 years. Again, some Midrashim say it was the same person. Now, this explains a lot of things, because if you're going to see Perek Chafches, which is really a lamentation over Hiram Melech Tzur, who was finally killed by Nebuchadnezzar, you see that essentially Hiram thought he was a god. Hiram's apparently living forever. He got basically deluded in terms of his arrogance, in terms of his power, in terms of his wealth, in terms of his arichas yamim, and we're going to see. So according to some, Hiram literally became crazed with the belief that he must be a god. And this results in why his ignominious downfall. Now, some Mefarshim, the Abarbanel, for example, learned the following, that Hiram does not have to refer to the same person. Just like Paro. Paro was also is the name for an Egyptian king. Sometimes you have repetitive names. And therefore, there's no need to automatically assume that it's the same person. And even the Midrashim, the Maral says, even when a Midrash says, for example, that Chiram was 500 years, or Chiram was 1,000 years, see, in Midrashic language, if two people share a common character flaw, the Midrash will say they are the same person. In other words, the Midrash may say, he is he, even though they're different people, if they share a common, either good quality, or a common bad quality. So sometimes when you read a Midrash,
like in Hass and Eliyahu and Elihu,
well, that's a possibility. Now, again, we many, you know, very often we understand that to be literal, because Eliyahu didn't die. That is recorded. But something like Pinchas's Eliyahu can also mean that they share a common midah. So be it as it may, according to some understandings, this Chira Melech Tzur just lived all this time, and he was finally broken and smashed by Nebuchadnezzar, who finally killed him. According to others, the reference here is not to the actual person Chiram, but the reference is to the notion that the kings who succeeded Chiram became arrogant and complacent and fabulously wealthy. And as a result, even though they were not openly hostile, they were not openly hostile to the Jewish people. And yet, there is a prophetic message of their downfall. And the specific reason is because, in a way, this is an old question people ask. Is it worse to hate, or is it worse to be indifferent? Which is considered to be a more negative. Now, we see, in a sense, that indifference is worse. Because indifference means you literally don't care. And if, for example, Ammon, Moab, Esav rejoiced in the downfall of the Jewish people, the Phoenicians didn't rejoice, but they didn't care. And in fact, there was a certain element of rejoicing, because they said, now we'll get some of the business. Right, for example, somebody, as you can see in a concentration camp, for example, this sometimes happened. If somebody would die, and they would have a pair of shoes or boots or something, so the only thing people would be happy about is, oh, now there's an extra pair of boots that's available. That's a very severe level of dehumanization, where you literally don't have feelings anymore. It's just a question of, what's in it for me for survival? And that's really, in fact, De Barbanel says, he gives a very graphic example of how this existed in Mitzrayim. It says in the Pasuk, Vayihi, this is in Shmos, Vayihi biyamim harabim haheim, after the many long days, Vayamas melech Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt, died. Vayanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avoda, and they groaned from their work. Now, if you look in Rashi, Rashi says, when it says Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim, it doesn't mean, I'm just quoting Rashi here, it doesn't mean Paro died, but it means Paro became a Metzora, and he became a leper, and it was necessary for his medicinal treatment that he slaughter Jewish babies, so he thought, and bathe himself in their blood. So the Abarbanel takes off on that Rashi and says, a very, very insightful comment. So, Jewish babies are being killed, but what does the Pasuk say that the Jewish people were complaining about? V'yayanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah. The only thing they could think of is, oy, there's more weight for us to schlep around. In other words, the dehumanization was so strong that when children get killed, all the parents could think about is, oh, we have to carry this too. V'yayanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah. So that's dehumanization, where you don't feel anymore. You just look at...
We have to carry this too. I don't...
Children were killed.
Right.
Their bodies had to be carried into Paro's palace to extract the blood. So the parents were so dehumanized that the only thing that bothered them was, we have to carry this weight. In other words, that's what happens. In other words, they stop thinking. When someone dies, you think about, oh, there's an extra piece of bread I can take. There's an extra pair of boots I can have. That's the dehumanization. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. I'm not comparing Paro. I'm actually comparing what happened to the Jewish people with the king of Phoenicia, although it came from an opposite source, and that is, with the Jewish people, the dehumanization came as a result of poverty and suffering. But with the Phoenicians, it came the opposite way. They were so into power and wealth that if a whole nation gets destroyed, all the Phoenicians think of is, oh, now there'll be a little bit more business for me to get. Now, yeah. Yes, we're going to have, yeah, we'll have that too, because right after, right, that'll happen too. Right after Tsur, we have three chapters of Phoenicia, there are four chapters about Pyro, so we'll have plenty about Pyro. But I'm making the point that with Phoenicia, see, the truth of the matter is, what's interesting is that on one hand, the rebuke against Ammon, Moab, Esav, and Pelishtim is very perfunctory and short. But these were nations who actively, number one, inflicted pain on the Jewish people many years, and these are people who are actively rejoicing in the Chorban. You would think they're worse. And yet Tsur, which was relatively benign, they didn't do anything against us. The rebuke is much more pointed and strong. But the concept is, number one, Hashem deals harshly with Tsur because these potentially were righteous people. These were people who should have loved and befriended the Jewish people. And or moreover, they show indifference. And the indifference and the callousness from someone that you expect more from is more painful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu than the hatred and the rejection of Ammon and Moab. And the phrase that they use here is Imala HaKareva. Imala means I shall be filled up with what is extracted from their Churban. Now again, keep in mind that we don't have the Bureau of Economic Statistics here, but keep in mind that except maybe during Shlomo HaMelech's reign, the Jewish people take over some of the business Eretz Yisrael gets from the outside. But if you net it all, the net benefit would not be very great. But in a dollar and cents level, every dollar counts. You know, we'll get a few extra dollars. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu finds that such a repellent, abhorrent philosophy that he talks about this. He talks about Tsur will be broken and crushed and destroyed, disintegrated. And the king that said he was a god, and that's why the Midrashim do see this, as he referenced to Chirim, I am a god, I have made myself. You will meet an ignominious fate of being destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. So here we see this idea that sometimes indifference is worse than hate. Because hate may have a reason. Chazal see this. Chazal say, for example, that Ammon and Moab, you know, may have feelings of rejection. After all, our Torah says, Lo yavo Ammoni Moavi b'kal Hashem. Our Torah does say, we don't want you. So, rightfully so, but still, one can be hurt, one can be rejected. And yet, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it were, doesn't condone, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, understands. But the indifference and the callousness of someone that we have always befriended, has always cared about us, that is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot forgive at all. There's no indication that he did. He knew Yirmiyahu, but there was some encounter, but I don't think he knew
Yechezkel. He would have made a terrific political advisor,
and
he known him.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's interesting. Yechezkel lived in Babel, and on the other hand, there's no indicator of any conversation they ever had, so I'm not sure. Although you would assume that Yechezkel, he would have heard about Yechezkel, because Yechezkel was doing a lot of things that attracted a lot of attention. Now, one point I want to point out about Perek Chafav. Perek Chafav is given a date. And if you look at the date of the prophecy of Tsur, this is Perek Chafav, Pasuk Aleph. Vayehi b'ashtei esrei shana. Ashtei means 11, right? It was the 11th year. B'achad l'chodesh, the first of the month. Now, first of all, the 11th year from what, and the first of which month? It's a very obscure date. But the way it is normally understood is, and again, we have to go back to this basic chronology, it was the 11th year of the Galus of Jehoiachin. Again, I have to remind you that the Galus of the Jewish people under Nebuchadnezzar occurred in two stages. Stage number one occurred when there was a king who only ruled for 3 months. His name was Jehoiachin or Jechoniah, that's the same name. And he was exiled to Babel, and along with him were the Charash and the Mazker. The Charash and the Mazker literally means the carpenters and the locksmiths, in other words, the skilled laborers. But Chazal understand Charash and Mazker to refer to Talmidei Chachamim, the learned classes. Yeah, I understand. But in terms of the 11 years, the Cheshbonis and Yechezkel, yeah.
Taking exception to two stages.
Okay. Well, two stages of Gullus. Kibush is not. Kibush is not.
Well,
conquest is not
Gullus. According to the description by Daniel, two different. The Gullus that starts in Yechezkel, but the Korban that starts in Yechezkel.
Right, okay. I understand. Yeah, okay. But again, the land had already been conquered by Nebuchadnezzar a number of years before. But they were allowed to stay. But the first wave of the exiles was under Jehoiachin, and this was 11 years before the Churban. In that Golos were people like Mordechai. Yechezkel was in that wave of Golim. And then there was still a remnant called the Dalas HaOretz, the impoverished people, spiritually and physically, materially, who remained in Eretz Yisrael, under the rulership of Tzidkiyahu, who was a vassal to Nebuchadnezzar, till eventually there was the Churban, the death of Tzidkiyahu, and the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Most of the dates of Yechezkel are dated from the Golus of Jehoiachin. So when it says it was the 11th year from the Golus of Jehoiachin, now that's very important, because the 11th year from the Golus of Jehoiachin is the very year of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. So this was a prophecy in the very year of the Churban. Now, when was it? So it says, B'yachod l'chaydesh, the first of the month. Which month? So some Mefarshim say, if it doesn't tell you which month, you assume it's Rosh Hashanah, the first Rosh Chodesh Tishrei. Others say it's the month of Churban, it's Rosh Chodesh Av. So this was a prophecy on Tzur, 9 days before the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And then the Talmud Yerushalmi says, very interesting point, that this was a prophecy of Tisha B'Av. On Tisha B'Av itself, I mean, it's not just any Tisha B'Av. The Tisha B'Av means the day that the Beis HaMikdash was burning in Eretz Yisrael. Yechezkel got a nevuah about Tzur. Now, how could it be Tisha B'Av if it says Echad L'Chodesh? So the Talmud Yerushalmi says that there is a concept sometimes in the Nevi'im called Kilkul Cheshbonas. Kilkul Cheshbonas means that when somebody is in a deep state of grief, they get mixed up, they say the wrong dates. That this was a Nevuah on Tisha B'Av proper. That Tisha B'Av. And because of Kilkul Cheshbonas, Yechezkel just forgot the dates. He wrote down the wrong dates, but this was a Nevuah on Tisha B'Av. So it's very significant. Did you see how important the Nevuah against Tzur is, that this is on the very day of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the focus switches from Bnei Yisrael, and there's a Nevuah on Tzur. So basically, as I say, Perek Chaf Vav talks about the downfall of Tzur, which historians say did involve a 13-year siege. In fact, it's interesting that Tzur is always called Iye Hayam, the islands of the sea. Now, in modern day, Tzur is not an island. Tzur, the city of Tyre, is connected to the mainland. But apparently, in ancient times, it was a separate island. And the Nebuchadnezzar, over the course of 13 years, constructed a landfill to be able to attack. So Tzur became joined to the mainland precisely as a result of this military action by Nebuchadnezzar. So this is the dominant avera for which Tzur is criticized is the phrase, "Imala hachareva, I shall be filled up with that which is extracted from that which is destroyed. And again, there's a very graphic description of Nebuchadnezzar's horses trampling your gates, knocking down your walls, destroying your might, taking over your wealth, and you will simply become a barren stone in which people will walk upon and they will slip. Because again, I mean, everything will be raised to the ground, so the stones will become slippery with blood and water, and there won't be anything, there will not be anything left. Perek Chaf Zayin also talks about this, but it's in the form of a poem, and it is called Saw Al Tzor Kina, Raise for Tzor a Kina, a song of lamentation, like Kinos. And the imagery that Perek Chaf Zayin, again, we don't have time to go through every verse, but the imagery that Perek Chaf Zayin uses is the imagery of a great boat, because after all, Phoenicia was the great trading power in the world. But as you know, there are many that believe that the Phoenicians discovered America. And there may have been some discovered North America, discovered America. Going all the way back to those years, there may have been some Jewish sailors along then, there too. But essentially, that might explain, there's all sorts of stories about American Indians possibly being remnants of the Aseret HaShvatim. This was a theory. Again, I'm not sure how much credence it has today. There's no Mukher in Chazal that would say one way or the other. But if you go back in the 19th century, it was a very popular theory among Jews that the Native Americans, the American Indian, were descendants of the lost Aseret HaShvatim. And because there are various artifacts that they find, etc. But be it as it may, many historians do say that the Phoenicians did get as far as here. So the analogy, the mashal in Perek Chaf Zayin is, you were a great boat made of wood and ebony and inlaid with gold and silver, and you had powerful oars, and all of the nations were operating your ships because they brought wealth to you, but your ship shall become grounded and then broken and disintegrated, and all of those nations will take pieces out of you. So the concept is the powerful ship that is torn apart and destroyed and taken over by the nations, but it's taken as a kina. Now the Medrash makes a very important point. This illustrates also the notion of not being happy, because a kina is mourning, sadness. Kinos is what we say on Tisha B'Av, and it makes the point, Sa'chazi, come and look at the difference between the Nevi'im that the Umos Ha'olam have, like Bilam, and the Jewish Nevi'im. That even when Yechezkel prophesies over the destruction of Tzor, there is sadness. There is compassion. And Perek Chaf Zayin is a dirge, it's a kina, because there is Rachmanis. And the Rachmanis is even greater for Tzor, precisely because Tzor had potential to be good and noble, but the wealth corrupted them. Of course, this is a theme that we see very, very often, as we know. Wealth corrupts more than poverty. Although it says, poverty is a trial in life. Suffering is a trial in life. But wealth and comfort and prosperity is also a very, very big nisayon. And Chazal say, sometimes the nisayon of prosperity and success leads to arrogance as even a greater nisayon than the nisayon of suffering. Lubavitcher Rebbe, that's how I used to say, I've mentioned it before, that it's easier to be religious in Siberia, than in suburbia. Because in Siberia, you know you can't escape being a Jew, so you turn inward and you turn to Hashem. But when all of the avenues are open to do what you want to do, it is so hard not to be arrogant and be faithful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
Part of the nevuah was to rebuke and have people change their
ways. No, that's what I'm saying. No, it's too late. As I said before, these were not nevuos that were communicated to Tzor.
Oh, okay.
This is to tell Bnei Yisrael that eventually those who rejoice in your downfall shall be punished.
It's hard to understand why it took 13 years to bring them down. If they're an island,
right?
And you surround an island.
Yeah.
Why does it take 13 years? I mean, then they can't do their training.
Mm-hmm.
What should it take 13 years for?
Well, the question is, how much food did they have, number one? Do they have 13 years of food? The question is, did Nebuchadnezzar have any navy at all? Because apparently Nebuchadnezzar could only attack them in that one way, by building the mainland.
And his armies were otherwise occupied
Yeah, Tzur wasn't the only candidate. Nebuchadnezzar had a world empire. Yeah, that's another thing. In fact, yeah. In fact, it's said by the American Revolution, too, that it was very fortuitous that it happened. England was involved in a lot of other things. And if they could have devoted their full time to the United States, they could have crushed the revolution very easily. So sometimes it's a situation, this isn't Nebuchadnezzar's only target. He's doing a lot of other things. And that's what happened. Even Yimach Shmo with Hitler, I mean, basically Hitler had multiple fronts, and that's Derech HaTeva, that's why we were able to conquer him. So that's the Kina of Tzor, the analogy of the boats. And then finally, Perek Chavches, I just want to show you some psukim, deals with the individual person of Chiram Melech Tzor. It shifts away from the society, and it focuses on the man. Now, as I say, the Midrash, in a very literal sense, looks at this as the same guy. He lived 500 years, he lived 1,000 years, although some might interpret it in a non-literal sense. But you see the phrase, look in Perek Chavches, Ben Adam, he reminds him, you are just a person. And Morlu Nagit Tzor, tell the king of Tzor, Komar Hashem Elokim, Ya'an Gaval Lipcha, because your heart has been conceited. Vatomer El Ani, and you have said, you are a god. Moshav Elokim Yashavti Belev Yamim, I have sat in the throne of God, in the heart of the sea. That's the concept of the island. But Hashem says, Vata Adam Velokel, you are just a person. You are not God. And yet, Vatite Libcha Kalev Elokim, you have made your heart like the heart of God. Hine Chachama Tami Daniel, are you wiser than Daniel? This is very interesting. You don't have that many cross biblical references in Sfarim, but this is the second time Yecheskel. This is the second time Yecheskel makes a specific reference to the wisdom of Daniel. He mentioned it before also. Daniel, as we know, was actually still alive at this time. Daniel was taken to Bavel as a young boy, and in fact, he was taken to Bavel well before the Golos of even the first wave. He was taken to Bavel as soon as Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Eretz Yisrael, and the king then was Jehoiakim, who was Jehoiachin's father. And Daniel, of course, became the great dream interpreter and the great assistant to the king. And the book of Daniel tells us that even though he was living in that hostile environment, he davened three times a day, and he would only eat vegetables, etc. And he went through the lion's den and all the other things. But he was known as a great chacham. His wisdom was known. And these are Hashem's words. Hashem uses Daniel in a way, I guess maybe Yecheskel might feel a little bad. Hashem is telling Yecheskel to rebuke, or to talk about Chiram by saying, are you wiser than the great Daniel? So Daniel is considered to be a greater chacham, apparently, than Yecheskel. Although we do know, of course, that Daniel is not treated as a Navi, very interestingly enough. Daniel's book is not in the Nevi'im. Daniel's book is in the Kesuvim. And that is because, the Gemara says, although Daniel had many, many visions, and in fact the revelation of Mashiach's date is in the Nevuah of Daniel, if you can figure it out, Parakid Beis and Daniel, but it says Daniel was not told to communicate in his lifetime his vision to the Jewish people. And a Navi, by definition, is someone that is given a mission to communicate. Without that mission, you can have all sorts of prophetic visions, but you don't have the status of a Navi.
Why Yehezkel? Only Yehezkel was called Ben Adam. Why did God chose him to be a Navi if he was so wealthy?
No, Yehezkel was not.
Every time when you say Ben Adam, you know that it's Yehezkel.
Well, yeah, Ben Adam is the common name that Hashem calls Yecheskel, but that's not because, God forbid, Yecheskel was haughty. But it's connected to the idea, part of it is that Yecheskel was the only Navi who got his prophecy in Golos, in exile. So Hashem is telling him that we are in a lower place here. We're not in the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. But the Ben Adam to Yecheskel is not to tell Yecheskel anything wrong with Yecheskel. But here, the problem person is not Yecheskel. The problem is Chiram. And he says, with your wisdom and your understanding, you did great things. You accumulated gold and silver. And it goes on, and your heart became arrogant in its might. Lochein, ko amar Hashem Elokim. Therefore Hashem says, Yan titches levavcha v'chalev Elokim, because you thought you were God, hinini mevi alecha zarim, I will bring strangers upon you, aritze goyim, the most powerful of the nations. V'heiriku charvosa mal yefeichach masecha, they will empty their swords, they will unsheath their swords on the beauty of your wisdom. The chilulu yifasecha, and they will desecrate your shining countenance. And it talks about the fact that you will die. And so unlike Chafav and Chafzayim, which are references to the nation as a whole, Perek Chafches is a kind of a very bitter cry regarding the betrayal of Chira Melech Tzur, particularly if it's the same person. We can understand this. Obviously this was a person who must have been tremendously righteous on some level, to be given this Arichas Yamim, to be given this wealth, to be given this power. Chazal even say that Chiram Melech Tzur was able to enter Gan Eden in his lifetime and take from the wealth of Gan Eden. And yet, when someone betrays that potential, it's a much greater tragedy than the person that never had it. And therefore, the Perek Chafches is actually a stronger denunciation than Chafav and Chafzayin, that simply talk about the nation and the culture as a whole. So this is Yecheskel's message to Tzur, taking up these three parakim. And again, it reminds us, the lesson that we take from it is the lesson of arrogance, the lesson of gaiva, the lesson of beginning to think that you're a god. And if you think about this, this has many, many parallels in modern society. Not so much that we can live forever, but as we're able to control more and more things, we do things that are godly. We can control the weather, and we can stop all sorts of things. Genetic engineering now. We can control, not yet, but we will eventually, science will be able to do all sorts of things, determine even characteristics like intelligence, how smart somebody will be, how strong somebody will be able to put in an order. Again, if we talk about the future, with all the, you don't even have to get pregnant. I mean, there'll be the various in vitro things, and eventually maybe babies could be brought to term in incubators.
This would be the end of the world.
Well, let's put it this way. In principle, there's no reason why, the natural progression of science could not lead to incubator babies. So you still would need human sperm and egg, but, you know, do it, bring it to term. And then people would fill out forms as to what they want for their child. Submit the form, there would be different rates, and you'd buy your child in the store, and there would be, and you could have, again, these are things which are entirely within the realm of scientific possibility. And the danger, of course, besides, you know, the breakdown of the family, which is a korban in itself, which we already begin to see, but there's also the attitude that I am a god, I control life, I decide what happens, and we see what that leads to. And that can lead to a person's leaving the way of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is what happened to Chira Melech Tzur, a person of such potential, of such greatness. And yet this arrogance basically drove him off the end. And that is the nevuah that Yecheskel gives here. Okay, I guess we'll stop here. Now the next section, we'll try to cover all of it next week, because I want to start the Nechamas per se, are four prakim. And the four prakim deal with the downfall of Mitzrayim. Now, Mitzrayim, too, is no longer a tremendously important world power. Mitzrayim was not yet conquered. See, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and this is in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 45 years. The 19th year of his reign was the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Mitzrayim was conquered by him in the 27th year of his reign. So Yecheskel is talking 8 years ahead of time regarding the Mapala of Mitzrayim. Now, Mitzrayim, we have a lot of enmity towards, not so much because of the Exodus, we kind of handled that already, but basically, in the waning years of Tzidkiyahu, who was the final vassal king, Tzidkiyahu was promised by Egypt that they would assist him in any battle against Bavel. And that encouraged Tzidkiyahu to wage war against Bavel. Last minute, Egypt just backed out. And as a result, we were lulled into a false sense of security, which resulted in the Churban Beis HaMikdash. So in effect, Mitzrayim was the facilitator of the Churban itself. And we'll talk about the Mapala of Mitzrayim next week. Okay, take care.
name 1 year ago? Or would one distinguish by saying Lifnei Shana Echad?
Lifnei Shana means a year ago.
Lifnei Shana means, well, then what means, what does Lifnei Shana Echad mean?
Well, it's gives it a little bit more emphasis. That's it. One year ago. It's really the same, but so it's...
Like a year ago and
no,
year
when
ago.
You'll tell me you had Hebrew a year ago, I would say I had Hebrew 1 year ago. There is more emphasis, that's all. But it's really the same as I say a year ago and 1 year ago,
well,
isn't
how about
it?
Before 1 year, or meaning longer than 1 year.
Lifnei shana v'chetzi. Lifnei shana v'chetzi. Lifnei shnataim, 2 years.
Okay.
Lifnei shalosh shanim. Okay.
It's like saying like last year and 1 year ago.
No, last year it's not the same as a year ago. Last year is what happened during the whole year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Last year I was studying Hebrew.
But this year, Hashanah.
No, it's not exactly as a year ago I studied Hebrew. It's different meaning in English too. A year ago means Lifnei Shana.
This year, Hashanah.
Hashanah.
Mm-hmm. This morning, Haboker.
Haboker.
Today, Hayom.
Hayom, okay.
This week.
Hashavua.
Hashavua. This month, Hachodesh.
Hachodesh, yeah. Okay. Okay. Sh'al shesh she'elot. I want you, with your partner, to ask 6 questions from the table of Ma'ose Dani. Just ask questions. Don't answer, okay? In the same small groups.
Okay. You
have to relate to the whole table, I mean both sides. Ma oseh Dani acharei ha-shi'ur? You can go that way, you don't have to go straight.
Laila
at night.
I thought it was a name.
Laila?
I know what it means.
Yeah. Night.
Oh, that's easy. Anyway. Is it?
Laila.
No, we're supposed to rotate all the names and make a few exercises.
Oh, so you should start.
Okay, let's see. Ma, Hossein, Hayodin, Esa, Asla.
Ba'erev. In the evening. Ba'erev.
have that word before? Do
we can talk about it in passing. I don't think I ever read it down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's school now.
Crazy.
The same school? Different class? So you grow with them? I mean, they don't change every year teachers? Okay. מספר 2. ספר. You have to answer orally the questions. מה אתה עושה בשעה 6 בבוקר? מי יכול? Who can answer it? מה אתה עושה בשעה 6 בבוקר? Travis?
אני עושה...
עושה only in the question. אני... sleep?
כן.
ישן. ישן. טראביס ישן בשעה 6 בבוקר. עד כמה? נכון? בשעה 6, דבי.
אני...
את הולכת. או נוסעת.
לא.
אני בעבודה. בעבודה. אני ישנה. אני ישנה בשעה 6 בבוקר. מה אתה עושה אחרי השיעור? בב?
אני נוסע.
נוסע.
נוסע הביתה.
הביתה, יופי. בוב נוסע הביתה, דבי הולכת לסופרמרקט, ג'יימס הולך לספרייה, library, ספרייה, אוקיי? מה אתה עושה בערב? In the evening, בערב, usually. בוב קורא את העיתון, paper, the newspaper. ברברה?
אני הולכת לכיתה.
לכיתה, אוקיי.
אני נוסע.
הוא לומד.
הביתה.
אתה נוסע הביתה, אוקיי.
למדתי עברית.
אחרי שאתה לומד עברית. משחקת. Why did I ask?
I asked that question.
Sorry. Mesachekit. It's not so hard. I mean, I never thought it's a hard verb. Maybe. Okay. Mesachekit. Mesachekit. Okay.
Mesachekit.
Sachkan, player, or actor. Sachkan. Sachkan. Mischak, game. ביום שני, on Monday, ביום שני היה משחק בין הברונקוס והשיקגו בירס. נכון? השחקן, the player, השחקן הטוב והברונקוס היה ג'ון אלווי. נכון? השחקן הטוב בשיקגו ברס היה something to do with Mac. משחק, game, שחקן, player, ולשחק, to play. משחק, exactly like מדבר. מדבר, משחק. מדברת, משחקת. משחקת, אוקיי? משחק, משחקת, משחקים, משחקות.
Now, can you use that in the same sense as kind of playing around, goofing off?
No, 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 that's no. דבי משחקת שח?
שש-בש.
שש-בש, דבי משחקת... את טובה?
ככה,
ככה. דבי משחקת שש-בש, בגמן. שש-בש. שש-בש is pretty when you get six and five. In the
on the dice
קוביות. אוקיי, שש בש, היא משחקת בערב שש בש. מה אתה עושה ב-12:30 בלילה? 12:30 at night. What you're doing? מה את עושה אחרי השיעור? So just for 3 minutes ask your partners, okay? You can, since there are 4 questions for a man and it's not fair, and 1 question for a woman, which is not fair, so you can turn it and change it to a woman question. I mean, okay, can you start?
מה עושה?
לישון?
To sleep. That's just what you want to do.
Okay.
You're just asking about the answer, I was
hoping. Okay. I'm dreaming. מה אתה עושה בשעה שש בבוקר? אני לא עושה, אני ישן, I sleep, אני קם, אני אוכל, עושה only in the question.
Oh, I didn't mean to say I meant sleep, I just said it wrong.
Okay, ישן.
I promise I didn't mean to do that, I won't do that anymore.
Oh, it's probably, ישן, ישן.
ישן, okay, אני ישן.
מעט
עושה
אחרי השיעור.
That's a good one. It's very relative to that.
Lesson. What?
Sure. But I just changed it to ma'at for it's for you.
What am I doing?
So what are you doing after the lesson?
Oh, after the lesson, that's right. I'll pray. Ani Nosa Hadoa, which is
Nosa?
Yeah. Remember the Nosa ones? Nosa. Hadoa.
Yeah. Good.
Okay. Ma ata ose be'erev.
אני לומד
הביתה לישון. לישון.
מה את עושה בשתיים עשרה
Vachitzi, Belila. I got that mistake.
This is 2:30 in the
12:30
at night. 12:30. I'd say sleeping, I'd tell you how, but I can't remember.
Yashin. Yashin.
Yashina.
Ani Yashina.
Yashina. Okay. Are you done?
There you go.
Oh, it's too short. Okay, just a few words before we go to the recess. From my experience, I'll be very honest with you. Sometimes, and David, I mean, you're a witness to it, because you just came, I mean, you came to the class, the beginner's class, I mean, Travis and Barbara and David's class, and you see that in how much they advanced in 2 months, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to believe. And I know that some students feel like that it's hard, but from my experience, after 2 or 3 lessons, you can be the best students in the class. I mean, if you are doing the effort. And sometimes when we start a class, the levels are like that. I mean, there are kind of differences, but you can do the effort and it can be changed that way. So don't feel frustrated or if it's too hard. It's not too hard. I know what you can do, and I mean, it can be later like that. Just make it.
הטייפ
שלו, יופי. השולחן שלך, ג'רי?
לא, אחר שולחן לא שלי.
השולחן לא שלו. אוקיי. הכיסא שלך, גוב.
לא, הכיסא לא שלי.
הכיסא לא
שלו.
אוקיי. הסוודר שלך? הסוודר שלו. הקוקה קולה דיאטטית שלך?
כן, הקוקה קולה שלי.
הקוקה קולה שלו. אוקיי, הכיתה שלכם? שלנו. אני המורה שלכם?
כן.
את המורה שלנו, יופי. הספרים שלכם?
כן,
הספרים שלנו.
המחברות שלכם?
כן,
המחברות שלנו.
יופי. Now I ask all of you, okay? Okay? The four of you, okay? הספרים שלכם? הספרים
שלנו.
הספרים שלהם, שלהם, their books, okay? המחברות שלכם?
כן, המחברות שלנו.
המחברות?
שלהם.
שלהם, שלהם. Can I ask both of you, okay? Mary and Miriam, okay? העת, let's put an עתים, that you have pens. העתים שלכן?
כן, העתים שלנו.
העתים שלהן. שלהן, יופי. השעונים, do you have a שעון? יש לך שעון? השעונים שלכן?
כן, השעונים.
השעונים?
שעונים שלנו.
השעונים
שלהם.
יופי. המשקפיים שלכם?
כן, המשקפיים שלנו.
המשקפיים שלהם. המשקפיים שלך? ג'רי.
לא.
משקפיים?
המשקפיים שלה.
המשקפיים? לא שלי.
לא שלי.
המשקפיים
שלה.
שלך.
שלך.
אוקיי.
כן.
המשקפיים לא שלו. המשקפיים
שלך.
שלך. שלך. שלך. הצ'ק, הספר צ'קים שלך?
לא.
זה צ'ק. כן. אני אצנות מה? זה לא שלי. כן.
שלי.
You see what Shali Shalom did with Hachekim.
Shalom.
Shalom. Can't be.
Hasfarim.
No, I lost the collective,
the plural?
Yes.
But it has nothing to do with how many objects we use. It's important to how many people we talk. It doesn't matter if we use ספרים or ספר. I can say הספרים שלך, הספר שלך. Do you get it, David?
Say it again.
I can say הספרים שלך או הספר שלך. In plural and singular, there is no difference. It depends to whom I'm talking. That's the difference in שלי, שלך, שלו, שלנו.
Yeah, but okay. Sorry.
ספרים is plural of
ספר. Our books.
הספרים שלכם, is it your books? כן, הספרים שלנו. It's our books. אני המורה שלכם, כן, את שלנו. זאת הכיתה שלכם.
כן, זאת הכיתה שלנו.
אוקיי. טוב, אנחנו כותבים על הלוח. Write it in your מחברת. בבקשה לכתוב במחברת.
Let me see.
That's you. Shell, look how I'm doing it. I find that's a better way to do it. Shell. אני. It's שלי. אתה. שלך. את שלך. הוא שלו. היא שלה. Now look where I put the small t. שלך. שלך. That's the A sound. So here it's under the lamet, so it's shelach. Here it's shel, cha. Masculine, okay? It's very similar to the lilecha, lo, la, la, nu, lechem, lechem, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, I told you, the first one is her. Okay, he. Anachnu, shelanu. Atem, you need more room, so it's not enough room. I mean, you need like for... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 11 words. Atem shelachem. Atem shelachem. Hem shelahem. Vehem shelahem. אתם מבינים את זה. Understand. Do you understand it?
אני מבין.
את מבינה. ג'יימס.
כן.
אוקיי, מרים.
כן.
אוקיי. I have some exercises that I prepared for you, so it will be more clear.
Thank you.